Best versus White, last page, Mr. Daisy. No?
Good morning, may it please the court, I'm Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. I represented Mr. White as his appointed counsel at trial and do so on appeal. The case comes before the court on direct appeal following a criminal conviction. It raises two issues, one a trial issue, one a sentencing issue, both subject to highly deferential standards of review on appeal. The first dealt with the admission of certain subscriber information from the Indianapolis Star News, retrieved by policemen from a desk in which two weapons were located by police that searched Mr. White's apartment. We argue that the court abused its discretion in allowing the admission of those documents at White's trial. The district court granted defense motions in limine prior to trial concerning marijuana discovered from the same desk, concerning probation documents outlining why Mr. White was on probation at the time of the search, and statements made by Mr. White at a probation revocation hearing on a state-related case, leaving very narrow grounds for appellate advocacy as to the fairness of the trial itself. The argument, the facts may be somewhat convoluted. The argument's fairly straightforward that the prejudicial value or the prejudicial effect of the admission of those documents outweighed its admitted probative value. The argument being that the connection between those documents and the possession of the claimed weapons was tenuous. It relied on several fragile links to establish any probative value, and that the court's decision that the prejudicial effect was outweighed by its probative value.
Judge Tender weighed that fairly carefully, didn't he? I mean, he didn't just jump into the idea that it ought to be admitted.
He made the government sweat bullets before he allowed its admission, of course, in the course of the trial. That is, the court required, whether he needed to or not, required the government to provide some evidence excluding other occupants of the home as potential thieves of the identity documents from the Indianapolis Star News prior to allowing its admission. So the argument is, I suppose, fairly simplistic, that the court had a decision to make in weighing those things, and that the court was wrong, that this court, the boundaries of its discretion were exceeded, and that this court should find that the court...
He did keep out the marijuana question after your client apparently admitted that the room was his, didn't he?
He did so. He did. As I say, we won about every other pretrial motion other than this identity theft document issue, and the argument is that he didn't receive a fair trial because of that. There's some tension between the government's argument that if wrong, this, the admission of this, these documents was harmless because there was so much other evidence indicating that White possessed the documents or the dresser or the room. That is, if that's true, the evidentiary or probative value of these items was unnecessary and rather slight to begin with. The sentencing issue is one confined only to the obstruction of justice enhancement that the court determined was applicable to White at the time of sentencing. And again, while the facts may be somewhat complex between the testimony of the witnesses, the declarations made between the witnesses and White on intercepted conversations from the Marion County, Indiana jail, the issue is fairly direct, which is what about the testimony that White clearly discussed with and solicited from these witnesses was false?
Including making sure they didn't tell you about it, right?
Apparently so. I guess my thought would be this, public defenders and federal defenders don't start out with the greatest public relations in the world with their clients. We often hear, you know, I wish I had a real lawyer rather than you. And which suggests it isn't surprising that a defendant might...
To which your response is, I wish you paid me a real lawyer's hourly fee.
Well, I suppose so. I, I have been actually drawing a paycheck for the last 3 years for this, so it's not entirely gratuitous anymore. But that is, the police testified that White said, look, it's my dresser, it's my gun, I'm holding the gun for somebody. The Johnson, the witness that was present at that time, didn't say anything inconsistent with those declarations. As I point out, it wasn't the greatest of defenses. If one was going to contrive witness testimony, I would hope one would try and do a better job than what these witnesses testified. Of the two guns with which White was charged with possessing, the two girls in the house at the time that the weapons were allegedly surreptitiously brought in by Ted, they only saw the larger of the two weapons placed in the dresser, testified. They only saw the larger of the two weapons placed in the dresser drawer. Lane, the witness who testified, it was really his room, his picture ID that was photographed on the desk, their personal items were his, testified that about a week earlier we saw White pick that longer gun up off of a couch and place it on a table in front of the couch in the room. But overall, the fact that the White's on the phone saying, look, I want you to get on point. There has to be some powwow before you talk to my lawyer. Doesn't imply that what they were discussing was false. The notion that White is saying, I've got a script, those pictures are the script. You need to be down with this before you talk to my lawyer. Again, as the United States determined from the testimony of, I think it was Baker, the pictures of the house were the script that White was referring to in these conversations with the girls. And so the argument is directed toward the notion that what was false about the testimony that was solicited by White isn't clear. It isn't clear from the court's findings, and that the finding that White obstructed justice was, under the facts and circumstances of this case, clearly erroneous. Absent some burning questions from the bench, I will sit down.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Daisy.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hallam?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is James Hanlon on behalf of the United States of America. Your Honors, with respect to the first issue concerning the district court's admission of certain evidence under Rule 404B, I certainly will not go through the four-factor analysis, as this court's very familiar with that. But I will say that the district court articulated the correct standard for the admission of that evidence, and then it correctly applied that standard to these facts. Two specific important factual findings that I will draw to the court's attention is that the court did, in very elaborate detail, explain why it concluded that the evidence was not being offered to show Mr. White's propensity to commit other crimes, but the identity of Mr. White as the person who possessed the guns that were charged in the indictment. Secondly, and importantly, I believe also, the district court was very specific in its findings when it found that the danger of unfair prejudice did substantially outweigh the probative value of the evidence that was being offered. I'm sorry if I said that wrong, that it did not substantially outweigh. And those are two critical points about the four-point analysis. Next, I would draw to the court's attention, I apologize to the extent that this was not made clear, as it could have been in the government's brief, the 404B evidence here was admitted in rebuttal. It was not admitted during the government's case in chief, and I believe that that's also an important point that I would bring to the court's attention here. Finally, I would point out that the district court gave the cautionary limiting instruction concerning what the jury could consider the 404B evidence for, not once but twice, both at the time of admission and then again during the court's final instructions. Based on all that, I submit to the court that the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting this evidence under Rule 404B.
What was the evidence that came in the case in chief that caused it to be the rebuttal evidence?
Your Honor, there were a couple things. First of all, during the government's case in chief, the lead investigator testified that there were two other people at this residence when the guns were found there. One of them, in fact, was in the room where the guns were found. Mr. White was not in that room, and also during cross-examination of the government's lead investigator, evidence was introduced that there was a Indiana photo ID sitting on the dresser in that room of a male that was not Mr. White. And then also there was other evidence during the defense witnesses.
Thank you.
Also, you're welcome. And then going on to the issue regarding sentencing, the district court here articulated the correct standard under United States Sentencing Guideline 3C1.1 and applied it correctly here. I will not rehash the numerous comments that were made by Mr. White during these telephone calls to his witnesses, nor will I go through in detail the testimony of those witnesses. Those are all laid out in painstaking detail at pages 7 through 14 of the government's brief. I will, however, submit that the really important thing here isn't even precisely what these witnesses said, but it's the very specific factual findings by the district court here, which are outlined at pages 79 through 82 of volume 5 of the trial transcript. In those findings, the court specifically found that Mr. White was attempting to orchestrate a false defense, that he gave instructions to the witnesses as to what to say and why they ought to say it. The district court specifically found Mr. White's comments were not for the purpose of simply refreshing the recollection of these witnesses. He also found that this was an attempt to concoct testimony, and based on all those factors, that's why the court found that the enhancement was properly applied under 3C1.1 for attempt to obstruct justice. The court also observed that it observed all these witnesses testifying, the context of their testimony and their tone. And as this court is aware, factual findings in the sentencing context are reviewed for clear error, and the application is afforded due deference, and the government submits that the district court did not err when it made its factual findings or when it applied the enhancement. And based on all of those reasons, the government would request that this court affirm the judgment of the court. And if there are no other further questions from the court, I would simply incorporate the points and authorities cited in the government's brief.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hammond.
Thank you.
Daisy, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
With the court's indulgence, I will use none of it. I thank the court's
response. Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.